This is an LA Times Studios podcast.
I was teaching at Pierce College.
Uh-huh.
And after class, it was a nighttime class, so after class I would go down to a country western bar before I'd come home. And there was this guy talking about his chainsaw leaning against the bar. And I went, oh my God, I have to have his babies. And I went up to him. I said, can I borrow your chainsaw? I have one. I said, I have one, but I had some work in my house and I think somebody stole it. He says, no, you can't borrow it. I'll come to your house. I'll cut it down. Okay. So he came and we were together 14 years before
Magic.
He dies.
What a line. Can I borrow your chainsaw?
Oh, here's even better. When I took the cabinets out of here to make my studio after he passed away, I found the chainsaw.
That's Serafine Segal, an artist, a painter, a graphic designer, and a teacher, living on an enchanting piece of acreage of house and garden in Studio City.
When I moved here, we used to have frogs, toads and stuff, and at night they would do their little chirping back and forth and communicating. And this year, and I don't know if it's because I have chickens or not, but this year I have seen more birds in my garden than I've seen in years.
If you hadn't had to traverse the LA freeways to get here, and you simply opened your eyes and looked around, there's nothing here that you would associate with the valley. Pretty things appear as if they had grown here. A sizable fountain, the bright twinkling of tchotchkes suspended in trees and hanging in doorways. Untroubled chickens meander along the grounds, and the dogs have already found and claimed my producer's lap. So you've lived in this place for 50 years.
50 plus? Yeah, ouch.
For someone who came here from the Louisiana countryside, L.A. had taken some getting used to.
The thing about smog is that it smelled, and it smelled a color to me because I live in color. And the way I described it was yellowish, greenish, murky. It's almost, the smell of smog was kind of like a horror movie. You know, after somebody's thrown up in the movie and you imagine the smell. So to me, that's what it smelled like.
Yet she took to L.A. and to its life of living on four wheels. In 1979, there she was, driving around the city in her snazzy little convertible, wearing one very personal aftermarket accessory.
I was driving over Laurel Canyon in a little British racing car, a Triumph TR4, to teach a class at the Egg and I Museum on Wilshire. I was recently from the Louisiana swampland into California, and I didn't know what smog was, but I knew I couldn't breathe. So I got this gas mask with two filters on it, and whenever I was in my convertible in traffic, I would wear it.
And this is how I found Segal. Or rather, she found me. I was writing a column about the very subject of this podcast, the story of L.A. smog, and I unearthed a photo in the Times archive. A woman driving in her Triumph convertible wearing a Dorothy Hamill haircut and a gas mask.
I am just before sunset, and a car pulled up next to me and flashed literally a neon sign that said L.A. Times. And he motioned to me if I would move over, and I'm going, well, he's probably from the LA Times, because who else would have a neon sign flash like that? So I pulled over, and he said that he was a writer and photographer for the Times. Could he take a picture of me with my gas mask?
That photo of her with her pixie hair and cheeky attitude made its way everywhere, even to her grandfather's general store in Gonzales, Louisiana, the jambalaya capital of the world.
But when it appeared in the Times, it also appeared on the AP wire service. And back in Louisiana, one of the country people went up to my grandfather and said, Leon, don't you have a granddaughter in California? And he says, sure do.
By the time Segal was bopping around town in her little Triumph convertible, Southern Californians had known for a good 25 years where most of the smog was coming from, right out of the exhausts of millions of cars like hers. driving created smog, and the smog was driving some Angelenos out. Up in the Bay Area, a legislator said he'd heard 10,000 people were leaving L.A. every year. Smack in the middle of that October 1954 smog siege, a South San Gabriel woman hammered a for sale sign into her front lawn, leaving because of smog. Before Hagen-Schmidt named the blame as the internal combustion engine, everything was suspect. One of L.A.'s serial pollution chiefs warned that, quote, anyone who smokes a pipe even contributes to the smog menace. And just you let a match smolder after lighting a cigarette and get dirty looks. For pollution police, nothing was beyond suspicion. At one point, I do not jest, housewives were asked not to shake their dirty dust mops outdoors. Dust mops! I shook my head at that one. Also, my mop. Even the optimists came off as pessimists. One county pollution boss said cheerfully that he thought smog could be cut by 80% within 2 years, but then he said industries would start using uranium and radium, and pretty soon we'd have radioactive smog. Good times. But most Angelenos were settling into an unhappy coexistence. Smog was here to stay. Make the best of it. A longtime L.A. mayor named Fletcher Bowron said as much on his radio show. Quote, we can never go back to the old days where the air was clean and pure and sweet and scented with orange blossoms. I'm Pat Morrison, and you've crossed the border into Smoglandy.
Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. They're drinking the water and breathing the air.
The air pollution police had already cleared a lot of the low-hanging polluters by the 1960s, like sources of smoke and gasoline fumes like oil storage sites. Air monitors went up all over L.A. County. In the 1950s, the Navy sent up blimps to monitor the air. For a time, a sheriff Cessna took to the sky twice a day with cameras and an air-to-ground radio to nail polluters in the act. So it boggles the mind that one of L.A.'s biggest pollution self-owns went chuffing right along for years, right in our own backyards. Unique to Los Angeles, almost every house had a personal backyard incinerator. Angelenos burned every scrap of household trash, and that cruddy smoke went up and out and over everything, 1,000 tons a day and more.
You didn't need to be an atmospheric chemist to appreciate that. Burning trash in your backyard is going to create a toxic brew.
This is David Zerler, the director of the Caltech Heritage Project.
You know, the idea that there wasn't regular trash pickup, municipal trash pickup in Pasadena until relatively recently, in the 70s and the 80s. It's an amazing thing to think about.
Incinerators were free trash disposal, and Angelenos just loved that. Something like 500,000 of them were still chuffing away in L.A. County in the early 1950s. And across Orange County, too, even as smog was strangling the people who used them. Hello? In July 1955, an L.A. County supervisor named Kenneth Hahn had made it his mission to get the filthy air of L.A. made fit to breathe. But at the same time, his own wife was burning trash in the Hahn family's backyard incinerator in South L.A. His daughter, Janice, is one of five Los Angeles County supervisors, and she remembers it very clearly.
My mother, after dinner every night, would gather up the paper trash, and she would go in our backyard, and there was a little literal incinerator, and she would burn our paper trash. That, of course, ultimately was outlawed. But, you know, people had certain practices that were funny to us now, but were very much a part of how they got rid of their trash.
Incinerators were banned across L.A. County by 1958, which is how we came to have curbside trash pickup. Not free, but not smoggy either, and landfills to bury our junk instead of burning it. When I say Kenneth Hahn made it his mission to clean up L.A.'s air, Mission Impossible became Mission or Else. On February 19, 1953, he wrote two letters. They were the first of their kind, but would not, as it turned out, be his last. Mr. Henry Ford II, the first one began, President, Ford Motor Company, Detroit, Michigan.
Dear Mr. Ford, as one of the five supervisors of Los Angeles County, the largest county governmental unit in the nation, I am vitally concerned with the problem of air pollution.
And then he jumped right into the arena, where he would stay for about 15 years, mixing it up with the big three automakers. Hahn laid out the case for the urgency of getting smog under control and reminds Ford of something they no doubt both knew. Quote,
Los Angeles has the largest per capita concentration of motor vehicles in the world.
And that the gases from them are part of the smog problem. Then Hahn wants to know.
One, are there any devices which can be attached to automobile exhaust manifolds or pipes which would effectively reduce exhaust gases? Two, if so, can these devices be produced inexpensively on a mass scale? Three, if there are not any such devices, is work being done to perfect anything to accomplish the same results? If so, what progress has been made?
And he went on, point by point. 2 weeks later came the first response. Three short, sharp paragraphs in a letter written not by Henry Ford, but by a PR man, and it bordered on the snippy. The Ford engineering staff, although mindful that automobile engines produce exhaust gases, feels these waste vapors are dissipated in the atmosphere quickly and do not present an air pollution problem. Therefore, our research department has not conducted any experimental work aimed at totally eliminating these gases. The fine automotive power plants which modern-day engineers design do not smoke, and he puts smoke in quotes, only aging engines subject to improper care and maintenance burn off. Red cape, meat, bull. And so began a remarkable, nearly 15 years long exchange of letters between Detroit car makers and that LA supervisor named Kenneth Hahn. When you're the youngest of seven boys, as Hahn was, and your father dies before you're born, as Hans did, you grow up to be a scrapper. The youngest member of the Board of Supervisors, he showed his willingness to swim upstream when he was the only white politician in the state of California to meet with Martin Luther King on his visit to L.A.
And, you know, my dad and his brothers owned a gas station. So they liked cars, too.
I didn't know that.
Gage in Maine. It was called the Hahn Brothers Gas Station. And he launched his first city council campaign in 1946 from that gas station. And the story my uncles would tell me was cars would come in to fill up, and unbeknownst to them, they would leave with a bumper sticker saying Hahn for city council on the back.
Hahn retired to his corner for a few months and in December came out swinging. He also wrote letters to General Motors, Packard, and Chrysler.
By scientific facts, it has been called to the attention of the Board of Supervisors by recognized authorities that automobile fumes coming from the exhaust contribute to the air pollution in Los Angeles County to a considerable degree. I have received a legal opinion from our county council, Mr. Harold W. Kennedy, which states that the Board of Supervisors of this county may pass such legislation that is reasonable and could require automobiles sold in this country to be equipped with a device approved by the Air Pollution Control District.
He got varying degrees of responses from informative to patronizing. Not for nothing was the youngest Hahn brother hip to the ways of cars and gas stations. Hahn's interest in requiring cars in L.A. County to be equipped with smog control devices was not an empty threat. In 1954, he ordered a headcount of all automobiles, all auto body shops, and L.A. County mechanics so that he could get a rough estimate on how long it would take to equip all vehicles in L.A. County with a manifold exhaust, should one ever be approved by the Air Pollution Control District.
So I think he was fighting this from a couple of angles. And of course, he was getting pushback from the automakers on his ideas. But I do think he was trying everything at his disposal to see whether or not legally they could require cars in Los Angeles County to do a certain, to have a smog control.
As California eventually did statewide.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. The man grew up in a car culture. The family ran a gas station. Moreover, his constituents lived in L.A., not Detroit. His constituents bought cars, a lot of cars. The science and the politics meant to him that smog was obviously L.A.'s problem, but Detroit's responsibility. The big car makers did not like being told what to do. They did not like being told to install seatbelts or airbags. And once they saw which way the smog was blowing, they certainly did not like the looks of coming regulations to make them make cleaner cars. In the 1950s, what Detroit gave us instead was razzle-dazzle, bigger cars, gas-eating engines, cars with chrome and big fins. At a national air pollution conference in 1959, a man named Chauncey Leak, an assistant dean at Ohio State University's medical school, mocked Detroit for it. Quote, "When are the automobile and truck manufacturers going to turn from the foolishness of fins, from silly style whims, from oversized models, and from too much horsepower to the essential but tough job of controlling exhausts?" The showdown was coming, and it was coming right here. In the mid-1950s, pretty much one in every 10 cars Detroit made was sold in California. In December 1958, a Cadillac limo was about to be delivered to L.A.'s mayor as his new official city car. He refused to take it. Smog was a killer, he said, and he wanted no part of a business that had a hand in creating it. So he bought an amusing little Nash Rambler instead. Hahn was playing a stronger hand than that. The R word, regulation, meant the same thing in Detroit as it did 2,000 miles away in Los Angeles. And Hahn was not subtle about making that clear to car makers. Big market meant big influence. Hahn was throwing around veiled threats of regulation in one of the automaker's biggest markets. They needed to come up with a plan, and in this case, business competitors found it more fruitful to stick together. Hahn continued writing. Back and forth it went for a dozen years, like a tennis match with postage stamps. Each time, Hahn asking when they'd have a smog device developed. Each time, the brush off. General Motors, we are continuing intensive development of the catalytic converter. Chrysler, the question of whether a device will be ready in 1958 is not answerable. Packard, our engineering department has at its disposal various types of analytical equipment, and through constant research and experimentation, have increased the efficiency of burning fuel many-fold in the last several years. And each time, Hahn getting more and more exasperated. In 1960, he informed Henry Ford II,
"I believe after 7 years, the automobile industry has had plenty of time to meet its responsibility to the people of Los Angeles County. Yet it has not done so."
2 years later, in a letter to General Motors, Ford Motors, and Chrysler, he said,
"Since February 19, 1953, I have corresponded annually with the chief executives of the major automobile corporations. During this period, major scientific accomplishments have been achieved. Man has gone into space. He has orbited the world. Electronics have advanced in every field. The jet airplane has been developed for normal passenger travel. Yet, the new automobiles coming from Detroit are still not equipped with a device to control fumes, which remain the major air pollution factor in Los Angeles County."
In 1967, Hahn reminded Democratic President Lyndon Johnson's Attorney General, Ramsey Clark, that the supervisors had been asking for years for an investigation into whether the car industry was illegally conspiring to balk at installing smog control devices. Well, in early 1969, just as the executive branch was about to change hands from a Democratic president to a Republican one, the Department of Justice did file a civil antitrust suit against the Big Four automakers, contending they had conspired to fend off anti-pollution devices, even buying up their patents to keep them off the market. The federal grand jury found evidence, but later in 1969, Nixon's Justice Department settled out of court. The car makers didn't admit doing anything wrong, and the secret grand jury proceedings would remain secret. Whew, boy, was Janice Hahn's father mad.
That was a little bit of a disappointment to my father, and I think one of his favorite quotes is he says,
"The presidents of General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler should be brought to trial right here in Los Angeles."
So Phil Burton then, when he was a member of Congress, got the evidence unsealed. And it proved that my dad was right.
She's right. A California congressman showed the world a secret document, a memo supposedly from the Justice Department's antitrust division around 1968, recommending that the big four automakers be hit with a charge of criminal conspiracy. The memo contains supposed grand jury testimony and exhibits that convinced those earlier prosecutors that the car makers agreed not to compete, to develop, to make or install air pollution control devices, quote, for the purpose of achieving interminable delays, or at least delays for as long as possible. And eventually, reluctantly, they had agreed to install these devices, if necessary, all at the same time. After all those years and all those stamps, turns out Kenneth Hahn was right all along.
He had a lot of victories over his 46 years in public office, a lot of victories. But this was really a huge one. And he just never backed down. It was his persistence. I mean, I think after 5 years, I would have quit writing letters.
Yeah, just the price of stamps going up alone. Hahn's pen pal letters weren't the only part of L.A. County government getting more aggressive about smog. How it happened after the break. While Kenneth Hahn was rattling the saber, or the letter opener, with the big three, air pollution officials were realizing that Angelenos needed to know more about smog than what their red eyes and raw throats were telling them. Pollution bosses tried to figure out how to keep the public in the know about air quality. In the early 1970s, for example, Ventura County's air pollution office tried calling each school to let them know about smog alerts and to keep kids indoors. But telephoning took so long that sometimes the alert was over before they got through the call list. They tried a call-in number to check air pollution status in your zip code, and briefly a rudimentary radio frequency. But what worked best and longest were official smog alerts. They began in 1955 and over time were refined into three stages. Eventually, there were thousands of alerts, sometimes 100 or more in 1 year. Mostly first-stage alerts, sometimes second, and almost never, not since 1974, a Stage 3 alert. That's pretty amazing in itself. Stage 1, unhealthy. Stage 2, very unhealthy. Try to keep the kids inside. Stage 3, hazardous, when authorities could close down businesses, schools, recreation, and most traffic, but pretty much didn't do it. Each stage was set by how many parts per million of ozone were in the air, and for health experts, the numbers were always too low. Nowadays, you can get air quality alerts on your smartphones for everything from wildfire smoke to the air around a refinery explosion. But back then, you relied on the newspapers, which published smog forecasts right alongside the weather predictions, and radio, and the TV weatherman.
No, the AKMD was a big part of our forecast every day.
That's Fritz Coleman, and for about 40 years, for millions living in Smoglandia, he was the weekday weather forecaster for Channel 4, the NBC affiliate in Southern California, delivering the smog news along with the temperatures.
Both in the current situation, particularly if it was bad, and the future, the forecast for the following day. And I remember the colors on the old map. It was green if it was good. Yellow was a moderate ozone pollution. Orange was unhelpful for sensitive people, meaning if you had asthma or pulmonary issues or cardiac issues, stay away. And then red, which we very seldom use, was unhelpful for everybody. And their recommendation was that you would stay out of the sunshine during the day if you could, because it was bad.
The smog alerts helped by transcending the artificial political boundaries of dozens of cities stitched together in a huge basin. Smog anywhere meant smog everywhere. One city, one county couldn't do much. Several counties could. So in January 1977, a new year and a new agency were born.
Prior to the South Coast, there were the four individual county air pollution control districts.
Here's Sam Atwood, who should know because he worked for that new agency, the AQMD, for years.
So there was the Los Angeles Air Pollution Control District, San Bernardino, Riverside, Orange County. and it was the amalgamation of those four counties. People just called it the AQMD. Kind of a mouthful even at that.
It wasn't the most mellifluous acronym, SCANQUM SQUAMD, but it acknowledged that air pollution was no respecter of lines on a map. Four counties were united and together began making and enforcing rules that eventually cut tons of pollution from fixed sources like power plants and the ones moving around the freeways. Ladies and gentlemen, check your filthy engines. Southern California was trying to craft a unified region from its smaller, smoggy cities, but what was the state of California doing to assert its pollution power? In 1967, a brand new governor, and a Republican one, Ronald Reagan, signed a bill creating CARB, the California Air Resources Board. Part of the battle against air pollution would now be fought by the biggest state in the union flexing its muscle. The next year, Reagan appointed that father of photochemical smog, Dr. Ari Hagenschmidt, to head up the new CARB board.
The amazing thing from in the trajectory of Ari Hagenschmidt's career is that he goes from the ivory tower professor who's only really interested in the basic chemistry to become director of CARB, the California Air Resources Board.
This is Caltech historian David Zoerler.
So he goes up to Sacramento and he begins what becomes the world's first and leading program devoted exclusively to air pollution from a regulatory political perspective that has all of the authority of the state of California.
But as we know from those sci-fi movies, whenever science has to get into the boxing ring with politics, it's often politics that lands the decisive punch. Hagi had not been shy about wanting smog control to be job one. Here's a reading from his wife, Zeus, from her Caltech oral history.
The automobile industry fought him tooth and nail. The oil companies did the same thing, because it became very clear that all their refineries were spewing enormous amounts of smog-producing vapors into the air, just like the automobiles did.
Here is Caltech Zoerler again.
But I think one of the lessons in the interplay between private enterprise and government regulation, particularly when it comes to environmental regulation, is that when done properly, a regulatory regime that is motivated by environmental considerations ultimately, in the long term, is going to make for better business decisions as well as better environmental outcomes.
Reagan was a conservative Republican, a business-minded guy, but I didn't expect to read this. 4 years after Hagi took on the CARB job, Reagan ordered him investigated for a possible conflict of interest. The question, did serving on the CARB board, which paid him about $10,000 a year, create a conflict with him being a paid scientific advisor to the L.A. Air Pollution Control District? Here's what Reagan said about it at the time, read by an actor imitating the governor's voice.
This was news to us. He's a very distinguished man. He's known, of course, as the man who discovered smog. He's served all of California well, but of necessity. And since this information came to light, I've asked State Resources Secretary Norman Livermore to look into this.
Odd, right? Hagi's work at the L.A. agency was no secret, but 4 years after he took the CARB job, there was suddenly a conflict? Growing up in the L.A. Times newsroom, where the saying was, if your mother says she loves you, check it out, I wondered, was this just about the CARB board's powers overlapping L.A.'s? Or had some businesses miffed about Hagi's forceful enforcement dropped a word to someone in the governor's office? Like 1972 does 2025. A year later, Hagi announced he'd be leaving CARB once the governor had a qualified replacement. Well, a few months later, Reagan fired Hagi along with three of the other five CARB board members. Reagan replaced Hagi with a Republican politician who just lost his re-election bid. The petrochemical expert on the board was replaced by an ex-VP of Standard Oil. And Standard Oil's nickname in California was the Octopus for its powerful political grasp far beyond its own business. Reagan dumped them all less than a week before a big CARB vote to require that owners of used cars, models 1966 through 1970, install a smog control device. The Sacramento Bee called Reagan's firings, quote, a ruthless political act. And the new board voted to delay the retrofit requirement. 1967, the same year CARB was created, the federal government gave California the equivalent of political power steering. The Federal Air Quality Act empowered the feds to control interstate air pollution with a special bonus for California. Republican Senator George Murphy had crafted an amendment for California carve-out. Because our air pollution was so terrible, California could request federal permission to set stricter air pollution standards than the rest of the country. And California did, and got permission for more than 50 years thereafter. Now, this bit I love. Senator Murphy had been an actor, song and dance man in MGM musicals, and was a friend and mentor of Reagan's. 3 years later, 1970, the year of the first Earth Day, the California waiver was confirmed by the Clean Air Act, signed on New Year's Eve by President Richard Nixon. But it was still almost always 2 miles forward, 1 mile back again proposition. Los Angeles Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman worked for 10 years before he could drag a more muscular version of the Clean Air Act across the legislative finish line in 1990. It gave Southern California more time to meet federal clean air standards, which it almost never has, and required that cleaner burning fuel be sold in all the nation's smog-bound burgs. President George H.W. Bush signed it, but 17 years later, his son's administration told California no when the state wanted to set its own tailpipe emissions rules. But then 2 years later, President Obama's administration gave that a big green light. So California got special power to deal with its special smog. But politics could only go so far, and here's where technology stepped on stage. During the game-changing smog attack of October 1954, Edward Roybal, the first Latino elected to the L.A. City Council in almost 70 years, had delivered some startling news to his colleagues. There was a car exhaust catalyst that could help cut the smog, a device perfected by a Mr. Eugene Houdry, and Roybal said L.A. should be testing it. Houdry was a French chemist and a hero of both world wars. He'd patented a method called a catalytic cracker. It turned petroleum molecules into gasoline more efficiently, which also meant more and faster pollution. But about 20 years later, Houdry read about Hagensmith's discovery of the cause-effect between cars and smog, and Houdry invented a catalytic converter process to clean up pollution from gasoline. However, these early catalytic models only really worked with unleaded gas. But once the U.S. started winding down leaded gasoline in 1973, merveilleuse. And so from 1975 on, new car models on California roads had to have catalytic converters to change the bad exhaust stuff into harmless stuff. They do that with rare elements like palladium and platinum, a couple of precious metals more at home in a jewelry box than under a car. That's why thieves steal our catalytic converters for those metals worth much as $1,000 for vehicle at some shady scrap metal dealer. Also after 1975, most of the cars Detroit made to sell everywhere were also California qualified. Then in 1990, California began requiring more zero emission vehicles. And boy, do we have some tales to tell you about that in the next episode. In the summer of 1979, while Seraphine Segal was tooling around Los Angeles in her little convertible and her big smog mask, another woman up in Sacramento was about to take on a very large job. She was Governor Jerry Brown's choice for the new chief of the State Air Resources Board, and she would serve on that board under four governors, Republican and Democratic. And it didn't take long before she earned a nickname and the authority to go along with it, the Queen of Green. Smoglandia is hosted by me, Pat Morrison. Our senior producers are Mary Knopf and Jonathan Shiflett of Studio Phonic. Our editors are Hugo Martin, Shelby Grad, and Steve Clow. Our director of library services is Carrie Schneider. Special thanks to Ben Kramer for reading Kenneth Hahn. Additional sound design and engineering by Hannes Brown. Our podcast marketing manager is Bryn Jura, and our product marketing director is Becca Dorman. Special thanks to LA Times Studio President Anna Mogzanian, President and Chief Operating Officer of the Los Angeles Times, Chris Argentieri, and Executive Editor of the Los Angeles Times, Terry Tang. Smoglandia is executive produced by Darius Derrickshawn.